welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 263 of the podcast. And it's 25th of March 2016 as I record this over a week early, as I will be in Austin, Texas, as you listen to this live. And I will have, when you listen to this, I will have spent the week at the Smarter Artist Summit and meeting up with a whole load of smart indies and entrepreneurs. And of course, as I'm recording this, I haven't left yet, which is quite weird, the time travel of podcasting. And I will update you on how it went on next week's show. Today, I have an interview with Michael Brent Collings, an award-winning horror writer and screenwriter. And he was on the show last year talking about religion and dealing with depression as a creative. And we had such a laugh talking about big topics that he's back to talk about writer's block, multiple streams of income, and a ton of other creative things. So we have a very jolly time and laugh a lot. So I think you'll enjoy this. No publishing update because I've just recorded the intro to last week's show. Just a reminder to check out the Indie Author Fringe for a free summit on all things indie, super duper content, etc. Just go to indieauthorfringe.com and that will be as this goes out. I think it will be next week when that will be out, certainly mid-April around London Book Fair. So definitely check that out, indieauthorfringe.com. So in terms of a personal update, since I've just recorded the intro to the Mark Lefebvre podcast from last week, I thought I'd do something a little different because I read a lot of nonfiction around the business and entrepreneur space, and I've just ordered a book in print, which I rarely do, and I wanted to tell you about it. The book is Anything You Want by Derek Sivers, and it's super short but full of insights, so highly recommended. Derek started CD Baby in 1998 as a way to sell his own music direct to consumer. Remind you of anything? And then helped a few friends sell their music and then sold the company in 2008 for $22 million. And of course, Book Baby is part of CD Baby now, and I know some people publish through Book Baby. So Derek is a creative who built his own tools to reach customers at a time of flux in the music industry. And since they're about 10 years ahead of publishing, we're in that same kind of flux now. So the book is well worth getting. Derek also then gave away most of that money and, as a real introvert, went to live quietly and just read and think. And he's a great inspiration to me as someone who's maintained his integrity, even whilst making a ton of money, and on how to make choices about all the things we could do. And he helps others. He lives the life he wants. He's just a really good minimalist kind of mentor. There's also a great interview with him on the Tim Ferriss Show and another one on the James Altucher Show, which I will link in the show notes. So there are a couple of things that had me thinking from the book. Here's a quote. Pay close attention to what excites you and what drains you. Pay close attention to when you're being the real you and when you're trying to impress an invisible jury. End quote. So this, I keep coming back to things like this because it's very important to me to be authentic with you guys, and you are actually listening to the real me. I am the real me at home in my creative cave, and which is, you know, super useful. You do get the real me. And I love to walk, and I'm loving training for this 100-kilometer ultra marathon thing I'm doing in June. I'm actually walking it, but this morning I did 18 kilometers, and I'm really tired, but I feel good, and it excites me in a kind of mental way to spend time in nature. And I wrote a lot of notes when I was going, and I started dictating as I walk, and I want to do more of that and more travel for my books, and I want to write more and create more and help more people, but do that through my online content, through audio. I'm going to be ramping up my YouTube channel and writing more books. You know, I think you, the listener would rather I learn more, write more, create more, and, you know, produce more than, say, answer more emails. And also, when I think about doing things in person, I really like meeting people, but it does drain me, and, you know, as a classic introvert. So I'm really only going to speak at things where I can say, hell yeah, I really want to do that. And that's this year, 2016, as I record this, I'm doing two speaking engagements. Well, three, I guess. I'm doing the Smarter Artist Summit in Texas, and then London Book Fair, and then Digital Commerce Summit in Colorado in October. And I don't want to do more. People ask me to speak all the time now, and I don't really want to do more because it actually drains me. I want to create more in my creative cave or out walking, you know, things that make me feel good about what I do with my life. And another thing that I find drain me are literary conferences. So a lot of us go to these as writers, you know, we go along. And what I've found is that that invisible jury, I really get that sense that I'm trying to impress people at literary conferences, because there's this jostling for position, this sort of, you know, who's better than who, who's got a better publishing contract, the indies at the bottom of the pile. You know, there's this type of inadequacy. I don't like feeling that, so I very much am going to avoid literary conferences. There's a difference between a conference like the Smarter Artist Summit and a actual literary conference run by the traditional publishing industry type people. So it's very important to kind of know thyself and get in touch with what makes you feel good and what drains you. And also thinking about where you are at the different points in the journey. So I listened to the Marie Force interview on Self-Publishing Formula podcast, which is a great interview. And Marie is amazing. She's got 50 romance books. She's grown this company. She's got all these employees. She started a publishing company, as have authors like David Wood with Griffin Wood Publishing, Liliane Hart with Silver Heart, Bob Mayer with Cool Gus. You know, or indie authors who have basically are moving into publishing. So, you know, it raises questions around, is the future of indie taking over the traditional industry? And in fact, if you look back at some of the biggest literary agencies and the biggest publishing companies, they all started with one author, one person, a couple of people. And in fact, you know, some of the biggest firms in the world also started the same way. Look at Google, two guys in a garage. So what starts as a small movement can turn into the establishment. So yeah, will indies be the establishment in 10 years' time? Will the top indies all start publishing companies, which will then get bought by traditional publishing? Who knows? But it has me thinking about what my own preference is and what turns me on. And what I love about this creative life is the creating and also traveling in order to fuel my creative spark and to, you know, put in my books and also helping people. Like, I really do love doing this show. And, you know, I do love getting the emails and the tweets that you find this stuff useful. And I want to keep doing that. I don't want employees. I don't want stock. I don't want a physical shop. I don't want to be physically located in one place. I don't really like working with people very much. I work with a lot of contractors, but I don't want, you know, full-time employees. I don't want people in an office, that type of thing. You know, I think it's very important to know the best way you work. I mean, my nightmare, the job I had, well, it wasn't really a nightmare. It was a very good job, really. But before, you know, the last job before I quit to do this full time, I was in like a massive floor, one of these cubicle nation places, about 400 people, you know, in one place, with, you know, in cubicles, and just horrible, horrible, horrible. And I remember how it used to drain me. You know, I definitely don't want to end up that way. So it's very important to think about what turns you on and what doesn't. I will be doing a lot more co-writing, more collaboration, and I will help my family, but I won't be starting a publishing company. Like, I really, it's interesting how I feel reacting to hearing about what other people are doing. And it's very important that you do the same. You may listen to me and say, I don't want what she has. I don't want what she wants to do. That's super important. So really focus. So my challenge here is, what excites you? What drains you? Be honest with yourself and write this stuff down. It's so important to self-evaluate and examine what you want with your life. And then just one more quote. Success comes from persistently improving and inventing, not from persistently doing what's not working. And I've been reading this, in the context of music, trying to market and flog a song that doesn't catch public interest is pointless. Just write another song. And of course, you know, hopefully you get the point. Many people write one book and then spend massive amounts of time and effort and years marketing that one book, and it just doesn't take off. It doesn't catch fire. The best thing to do is to persistently invent more, create more opportunities, and maybe something will catch fire. You look at some of the most prolific authors. I mean, even think about someone like Stephen King, who's written, I think, about 50 books as well. How many of those, even if you're a Stephen King fan, can you name? Like, what are the books you could name? For me, it would be The Stand, obviously. That's like my number one Stephen King. And I could probably, It, I really love as a book as well. I mean, there's probably six or seven that I could name. I can't name all his books, and not all of them have taken off. So that's the most important thing, is don't persist in doing what's not working and advertising something that doesn't work, but write something else and see what happens. Okay, so there are no comments or tweets this week because I've recorded this back to back. I will do a double shift intro for the next show, when I will also tell you all about the Smarter Artist Summit. In the meantime, please email me or tweet me with what you're doing while listening to the show and any pictures of where you are in the world. I love the interaction we have on the show, and I really appreciate you getting in touch. So this podcast episode is sponsored by 99 Designs. You can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. So I'm sure you've heard many times before that on 99 Designs, you can get all kinds of designs for your author business. Of course, you can get book covers. You can also get merchandising, branding, business cards, illustrations, artwork, and much more. So this is approximately how it works. You do your design brief. You say, for example, if it's a book cover, what goes on the front, the title, subtitle, author name. If it's print, what goes on the back and the spine as well. Give some idea around genre, the feelings you want to evoke, cover ideas around the places, the objects, the feelings, and examples from your genre. The designers will never read your book, so you have to provide them with this type of information. You'll then get lots of submissions, and you can give feedback, leave comments, and you can also do a poll to your social media or email list. Once you pick the winner, you will get the files and you're done. Now, I have a cover designer, but I've used 99 Designs for custom illustrations, including the map at the front of dark fantasy thriller Risen Gods, a map of Aotearoa, New Zealand, which I love. It's awesome. In fact, I might even make it into a poster one of these days. You get a 100% money back guarantee, and you don't have to pay if you don't get a design you like. Of course, going back to book design, I think book cover design is the best marketing asset you can have, so well worth investing in, and it will make your book stand out in 2016. You can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. I really appreciate your support. It means a lot to me, and I love the interaction we have, and I love that you guys want the show to continue. If you're interested in supporting the show on Patreon, check it out at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, let's get into the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Michael Brent Collings. Hi Michael Brent.
Hello, how are you doing?
Oh, it's great to have you back on the show. Just a little introduction. Michael Brent is an award-winning and internationally best-selling horror novelist, a number one bestseller in the US, and also a screenwriter and martial artist. He was on the show. Yeah, boom. And Michael Brent was on the show last year, and we talked about writing horror, about religion and faith, and also about depression. And incredibly, we had a lot of fun. And it was one of the most popular episodes last year. So Michael Brent is back, and we're going to talk about some different things. So let's start with an update. As a full-time creative, what has changed for you in the last year? What creative projects have you been working on?
Oh, creative projects.
Yes.
I thought you were asking about like my hairline, which is always sort of a steadily receding thing. Creative projects, I have written a number of books. I typically write anywhere from 4 to 8 books a year. So I've written, since last time we spoke, I wrote The House That Death Built, which is my newest release. I wrote The Sword Chronicles, which is a YA fantasy. And I finished off a zombie series called The Colony Saga. And I think I did a couple other things, but I honestly, they all kind of blend together. I've written like 40 books in the last 5 years, and they all just kind of smoosh after a certain point.
I know, and I'm struggling, and I'm only on at like number 17 or something. And you feel like a bit of a dick when people say, how many books have you written? And you're like, I can't quite remember.
Right.
Sorry.
You tell them that you say, I'm not sure. And it's not because of how many I've written. It's just because I'm a writer and I'm not good with numbers.
Yes, but we're creative entrepreneurs, so we have to be good at both.
That's true.
But we're going to come back to your output and talk a bit about writer's block or lack of. But I wanted to ask you, well, first of all, I wanted to say a big congratulations for your nomination for the Bram Stoker Awards.
Yeah, two of them.
Two. I will read them out. So, superior achievement in a novel for The Deep, which I personally loved, and I really want to write a scuba diving book at some point. So it's a great inspiration for me. And also superior achievement in a young adult novel for The Ride Along. So this is two indie published books alongside Stephen King, Jonathan Maybury. So first of all, tell us how that feels.
It was really a surprise. I mean, they have a preliminary ballot where they kind of announce these are the ones that are in contention for the real ballot. Or I guess you're British, so the real ballot. And I didn't expect to get past that. I mean, it was nice to get recognized on the preliminary ballot. And then because I troll Google for my own name periodically, I pulled it up. And I wasn't even looking for the Bram Stoker. It was just completely off my radar. And it pulled up that I had gotten a nomination. And I thought, oh, probably for The Ride Along, because there weren't as many young adult novels. And because superior achievement in a novel is really hotly contested. And so I pulled it up, and I honestly, I just about pooped my pants. I was just so surprised.
But that's interesting. So did you not enter the books yourself?
Well, you always have. I'm a member of the Horror Writers Association, although I have to up my dues. So I guess technically I'm not right now. But you let people know that they're out there, and then the other people kind of do what they want. You're not really supposed to solicit votes. And I didn't go around on social media going, if you'd vote for me, that, you know. Mm. So it was nice to see it show up, but it wasn't. I don't have the time or the wherewithal to put a huge marketing blitz into the Bram Stoker Award. I'm too busy kind of selling books on a day-to-day basis.
Mm, no, absolutely. I agree with you. But it seems a really big thing. Like I read a little bit of horror, you know, your books and some other, and Stephen King and Jonathan Maybury, actually. But that's...
He's good.
Yeah, he's really good. I love the Joe Ledger series.
Yes!
It's so good. But what I wanted to ask you was, you know, many people criticize indie books on quality, and your writing award nominated. You've won other awards though, haven't you, as well? So you are an award winning novelist. So how do you write an award winning book, or what are your tips for writing books that can win awards?
You know, for that's a great question for indies, especially because when I'm talking about how to get independent books recognized and get them spotted amongst this vast sea of self-published stuff, what I tell people is you don't want to be as good as the publisher, the traditionally published books. They have that space totally occupied. So the space you need to create is to be better. And I really mean that. So if you have a choice between a Stephen King book and a Michael Brent Collins book, the first thing you're going to see is the cover. And so you need your covers to be more popping, more eye-catching, more interesting, more innovative than the covers you'll see on a traditionally published novel. And so oddly enough, I think the closest kind of correlation would be sort of a civil rights movement. When I love Dr. Martin Luther King, and one of the things that he kind of seemed to emphasize was you don't want to go out and be militant and be nasty about stuff. You want to just be quietly excellent as a human being. And I think that applies in all areas of life, and particularly to indie publishing. As soon as you get out there and start screaming, I'm just as good as you are, listen to me, people automatically just kind of go, and they're gone. So you need to put out a quality product and say, hey, read the first five pages. And if it sucks, throw it away. And I've got my big boy pants on and I won't be offended, because that's my job as a writer, is to listen to what you want. And if I didn't achieve that, it's my fault. And once you have that mindset, it's much easier to approach people because there is that bias. But if you tell them, look, I've had bad reviews, they didn't hurt my poor little feelings, and I'm willing to accept your criticism the same way I would accept any other business decision. And as soon as you do that, people go, okay, well, I'll take a chance. Mm-hmm. But then you really do have to knock their socks off. And you know this, you can't say, well, I'll be good enough for a 99-cent purchase. You have to say, I'm going to give them a $15 experience and then sell it to them for $5. And that's how you get an audience. You give them value for what they're giving to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree on that kind of quiet excellence thing. Again, we talked about religion before, but, you know, it's pretty similar. If you're a person of faith, you don't want to go around preaching it. You want to live it. And then people will recognize that and they'll ask you, you know, oh, and eventually they will ask you about it rather than you having to kind of preach it. So I agree with you on that side. But I wondered, I mean, obviously you have friends in the traditional publishing arena and, you know, with organizations like the Horror Writers. Have you seen the attitude towards indies? Has it completely shifted now, or do you still see some backlash?
No, absolutely not. I was actually... The Horror Writers just last year agreed to accept independent authors as members of their group. And there's still a lot of pushback. I was actually one of the people that drafted the new rules, or that I guess I provided the recommendations for new rules to the committee. And there were people that said, no, unless you have sold to a publisher, you are not a real writer, which I thought was ludicrous, especially based on some of the crapola I've read from traditional publishers.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, it's true. They do have gatekeepers. And I never will mock traditional publishing as a whole. I mean, there's some bad apples out there, but they have a place. And if I got the right offer, I'd take it. I have nothing against it. But there definitely is a very strong, probably still majority faction that says, no, if you just click publish on Kindle, it's not for realsies, you know, and they're not willing to even give it a chance. And again, I bear them no ill will for that, because there is a lot of dreck out there. And after you've dated 18 weirdos, you really are kind of careful about the next person you ask out on a date, you know? And it's the same thing with books, because you're establishing a relationship with these books and you bring them into your heart and you open up to them, and then they stomp around and they piss all over you with crappy grammar mistakes and bad spelling and all of this stuff, which is, it's actually why one of the first things I say to new writers is, this is a great rule to learn. Your first book sucks. Don't publish it. Don't think you're an exception to the rule. You just wrote crap, and that's okay, because crap is the first thing you have to write to get good. Mm. So again, I don't bear anyone any ill will. Sometimes I do kind of go, I've worked really hard for my reputation. And if I come to somebody and say, would you read my book? And they say, no, it's self-pub. And I'm sitting there going like, I've got major award nominations and I sell more books than you ever will, you know? And at some point you do kind of get frustrated out there and hope that those people sometimes change their mind.
Yeah, no, exactly. I agree. Okay, so let's talk about actually making a living writing, which you do. And you mentioned there the 4 to 8 books a year that you're writing. So what does your writing process look like right now? And maybe how has it changed over time? Has it got faster, for example? Obviously it has.
Well, yeah, when I was a kid, you know, all I could output was 1 or 2 Crayola stories a day. And clearly I'm a little better than that now. You know, it's really interesting because people ask, like, what do you do? And the secret is I go in and I sit down and I start typing and I don't stop for 8 or 10 hours. And some days that means I type total crap. But you know what? That's what God invented the delete key for. So it's okay that I write total crap. And even in writing the total crap, I learn how to be better the next day. A huge mistake that people make is they sit there and they write something terrible, and then they use that terrible thing as an excuse to not write the next time, because what if I do it again? And that's fine. I mean, if you look at an Olympic pole vaulter, how many times does that dude hit the bar when he's trying for a world record attempt? Hits it all the time. And that's fine. That's part of the process. You've got to screw up in order to really excel.
Mm. So you mentioned there that you go in presumably the room and a specific room and you write for 8 to 10 hours a day. So do you not plot or plan your books? Are you like what they call a pantser?
No, I do outlining, but here's another thing, because we're kind of moving into writing process and how not to have writer's block and all that thing. A lot of people, they misconstrue a critical element of writing, and they think writing is totally equal to typing. Mm. And unless I'm typing, I'm not writing. But the reality is, writing is this whole gamut of interesting processes. So if I go in and I say I'm writing for 8 hours a day, that means some days I'm outlining and I get 3 pages done. And some days, like today, I'm brainstorming, which means I'm sitting down and watching anime. Okay. And I'm just sitting there with like a piece of paper or a pad of paper and just writing as fast as I can these ideas that come out. And that's writing. I write every single day for all this time. And some days when I sit down and I actually start typing, yes, I can hit up to 15,000-16,000 words a day if I'm really pushing myself. But if I don't type that much, I'm not beating myself up, because I'm either critically watching a TV show to find out how I can put to use things that they do well, or how I can do better things that they suck at. Mm. Or I'm writing, or I'm reading a book, I'm thinking. One of the things that I very often do, my wife says, excuse me, what are you going to do today? And I say, I'm going for a nature walk. There's this really beautiful nature hike near our house. And I just walk for a couple hours. Again, I have my pad. So I'm not just foodling around. It is for a real professional purpose. And I think that's another difference, is there is a slim line between that and then just kind of putting your feet up on the porch, watching the sun go down, and thinking writerly thoughts, which is a huge danger, because then you're not actually working. But as long as you're working on your piece, it's writing and it counts.
Yeah. And I think that the problem, like I was reflecting on what the problems with my first novel, one of the things that people often do with that first novel is they read a lot of books about writing. They go to a lot of workshops on writing, and they listen to a lot of audios about writing,
right,
but potentially don't move past that point. So, for example, you mentioned they're watching TV shows as learning about story and critically watching TV shows. I gave up TV at that point, like 5 years ago. But now, whatever it was 5 years ago, now I do watch more TV again because there are some great shows on Netflix and Amazon Prime and all that type of thing. So I guess, how do people know when to stop putting that stuff into their brain and when to stop walking and when to stop finding ideas, right, and when to actually, you know, get the work done?
Well, okay, so research is a great thing, but it becomes a four-letter word. It becomes this tremendous crutch that we use to avoid writing. And the reality is, there's always more to be learned, and that's wonderful, but there's always more to be learned, and that sucks, because we use it as this excuse. Well, I don't know enough about guns. I don't know enough about submarines. I don't know enough about scuba diving. And what if the world's expert at scuba diving reads my book and realizes I'm a fraud? And we kind of bind ourselves into this mentality. But the reality is, we're creating fake worlds. We're lying for a living. We're con men and women. And so all a good con artist needs is enough facts to lie convincingly. And as soon as you find yourself at that position, start typing, start creating something. Similarly, if you are watching a TV show, again, I'm sitting here with a pad in hand, and I go, oh, a giant monster that spews molten lava and has parent issues. That's great. And so I'll write monster with Oedipal complex, you know, and so I'm actually trying to transmute what I'm seeing into something I can do, and not stealing it necessarily, but saying, this is a great springboard. And as soon as you then sit there, this is how most people watch TV.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a very encompassing medium. And so it's very easy to kind of go cold and just let it wash through us. And as soon as you do that, you should not be sitting there thinking, okay, I'm going to watch TV. You should be sitting there thinking, I'm going to get excited today. I'm going to watch a great show, and it's going to help me go to completely new places. And as soon as you're kind of out of that mindset, now you're just entertaining yourself. And that's not your job. If you want this for a job, you can't just sit back and be entertained. And this is going to ruin television watching for you and for your spouse, because my wife, she knows, like, we'll watch a mystery and I'll go, he did it, third frame in, you know? And she just sits there and turns to me and goes, you a-hole. Because she, and now she's doing it. She's going, ugh, he did it. And she still turns and goes, you a-hole, because it's all my fault. And so every time I'm watching a show now, I really am looking for cool tidbits, and it's a really fun way to live. And it trains you to look for interesting moments everywhere, because if you can look for cool stuff in a television show, which is designed to sort of deaden you, when you're driving down the street, all of a sudden you're going to start saying, that is a creepy warehouse. I wonder what's in that warehouse. And then, because you're a writer, writers get to do this. You walk up to the warehouse and knock on the door, and they open it and you say, I'm not a terrorist. I'm a writer. Can I see inside your warehouse? And they go, sure, you know. And so the secret really is being engaged. As long as you're engaged, it's great. And then as long as you feel like you have enough information to get started, get started. Because chances are the world expert is never going to read your book. And all you have to do is fake out the masses. Who are smart, and you need to do a good job, but you don't need to be the world expert. You just need to be more expert than they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that curiosity, trusting that curiosity, is something that I didn't have at the beginning. You know, after 13 years or whatever it was in a corporate job, you know, you lose your creativity, and you, it's interesting. I think you lose your trust in that curiosity that says, I'm interested in this, notice this. So it's almost like you have to train your brain to start noticing it, don't you?
Yeah. And the older you are, here's what I think is the real problem. It's not like a corporate life, but it's that the older we are, the more asking questions costs us. My 3-year-old, I say, don't do that. Why? Because this. Why? Because this. Why? Go to bed. You know, and at some point, she can outwhy me because she's infinitely curious. And then we get older and we get more people saying, leave me alone. You're asking too many questions. And then we're in our 20s, 30s, 40s, and we say, what about this? And they go, don't you know that? Mm-hmm. And now we've been taught that asking questions marks us as fools. Mm-hmm. And what we need to say is that's not true. You know, nobody learns more faster than these kids because they ask why. And so I literally, you have to be able to say, I'm a child again. And it's not just part, saying I'm a child again isn't just like, oh, how wonderful the world is. It's wondering stuff. And I do, I literally, I'll pull off the side of the road. My family hates traveling with me because I'll pull off to the side of the road and I'll just run up to a building and I'll say, I see you have a farm. What's that like? And the person looks at me like I'm an idiot until they realize I'm really interested. And people gravitate to that interest because everyone wants to talk about themselves. And interestingly, the more fascination you can have with things and people, the more people are going to be fascinated by you because they sense a person who has a deep appreciation for who they are. And that comes across in your books.
Mm. Although I would say that as a kind of chronic introvert, I never, like, my research process basically doesn't involve talking to people. It involves reading a lot of nonfiction, biography, yeah. A lot of, you know, technical stuff, or like I'm reading some stuff on war photography at the moment because mm-hmm. I want to write a character who's a war photographer,
right.
And traveling places. And, you know, researching that way. So I think if people listening are like, I couldn't go up to a farmer and ask about that. Yeah, you don't, it doesn't have to be that way, but you need some way, no. You need some way to get the input, don't you? Let's talk a bit more about writer's block. Cause I always feel when people email me and say, I've got writer's block, I'm like, you just haven't put enough stuff in your head because for it to come out again, you have to put it in. So what's your interpretation of what people call writer's block?
Okay, so first of all, there's a misconception and there's a misnomer. The misconception is this. So picture you've been pulled over by a police officer and, you know, you do that whole thing where your butt like clenches and you rise up 6 inches in your seat because you're terrified of what's going to happen. You get a book and he says, do you know how fast you were going? And you do. You were going 117 miles an hour in a 7-mile zone. And then he starts writing and then he just closes it and says, you know, I'm just not feeling it today. I must have cot block. And he walks away, right? And so this never happens. And if you're going to be a professional writer, you don't have the luxury of saying, I have writer's block, any more than there can be accountant's block or lawyer's block or doctor block. You know, oh, let's stop the surgery. I'm having gallbladder doctor block. You have to do this. Now, that's the misconception. So get over writer's block because you're not allowed. The misperception of writer's block is it's not that you can't write. It's that everyone has this little – one of my teachers called it a crap bird. He actually called it something else, but I'm editing for content. So he calls it this crap bird, and you put your hands down to write, and before you can write, you have a concept. You have an idea or a series of words. And right as you're putting your fingers down the crap bird goes, those suck. And you immediately pull your fingers back off the keyboard. And so writer's block, it's not that we don't have words. It's that there's something inside of us that's saying, don't write these words. They're terrible. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's the case. But you know what? Terrible words are better than no words at all. I would much rather have a world where people speak inelegantly and imperfectly than a world where no one speaks at all. And so when we talk about writer's block, part of the way of getting through it is writing gobbledygook. And I do that some days. But the thing is, as you write gobbledygook, you're going to find more and more all of a sudden you start writing wonderfully. And if you're not, it's not a writing issue. It is a plot issue. And that's where a lot of people get hung up too. Again, if you're having a plotting problem, just working through it sometimes is the best way. But another thing is, again, typing is not the end-all be-all of writing. So if you're having a plot issue, That's fine. That's part of writing. Mm-hmm. Think about it. Wonder about it. Worry about it. That, again, I was a lawyer, and there was a lot of times where I sat in front of my computer going, how am I going to explain this to a jury? And it wasn't lawyer's block. It was part of the process of getting together a good case. So if you're sitting here going, how am I going to get my hero out of this situation? That's not writer's block. That's pondering. And that's fine. Now, if you find you truly can't get your hero out of that situation, again, write crap. Type out, and then God reached down and saved him. Deus ex machina. And you know what? All of a sudden you realize, well, God can't save him, but a helicopter would. Well, there's no helicopter in this story. Page 3, he looked up and saw a helicopter. And now, you know, you can layer in the answer. So getting through writer's block, really, it's getting out of your own way. And again, I like to liken this to everything about writing is pole vaulting. It's a very good analogy. And these Olympic pole vaulters, when they're running, they don't go left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot, plant the pole, up, bend, heel, huh, you know, they just do it. And that's because they've practiced, and they've fallen, and they've made missteps. And when the final moment comes, they just get out of their own way, and suddenly they're on the other side of the rod thing. Use words good. They're on the other side, and they've passed the test. And that's very similar for a lot of people that have writer's block. Just start writing any old bloody thing that you feel like, you know. He was inside with the zombies. Oh, crap, what do I do? And suddenly a cuckoo bird walked in. This isn't making any sense. Shut up, crap bird. And the cuckoo bird said, there's a way out. Okay, so we're not going to have a cuckoo bird, but now we have somebody who shows up, and we can layer him in earlier, and the problem's solved. Mm-hmm. And it's all solved by just typing any old stupid thing. It's the best remedy for writer's block.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I had David Morrell on the podcast a while back, who wrote First Blood, Rambo, and 40 other books. A couple of small things. And he said he just writes a letter to himself as he's sitting there. So he'll be like, yeah, like you say, this is a stupid idea, but what, you know, what could happen? What are the 15 things that could happen next, David? Well, right. You know, and actually just uses that letter to kind of decide. So a couple of things there. The layering in, the kind of what some people might call foreshadowing, I think that's something that early writers don't realize either. As you said, you come up with the idea and then you have to go back and just add a few things in, like tiny little things earlier on, like give them a knapsack or something so they can take something out of the knapsack later on.
Right.
Yeah, I do that a lot. I often have flashlights, as you call them, or torches. Right. I'm always getting that wrong. So that was one thing I wanted to say. The other thing I wanted to ask you here about, because, you know, you enjoy a good laugh, but you write horror, is taking everything a bit too seriously, especially with the award-winning stuff. So do you think that some people struggle with writing? Yeah, because it's all just a bit too serious?
Probably, because again, they're like, people are saying, I've got to achieve this huge result in this perfect moment. And you know, human existence isn't a series of perfect moments. It's a series of really banal moments that are punctuated by amazing moments. And I think that we definitely put too much pressure on ourselves. Certainly me, I do have this. I suffer this when I'm writing. I'm like, I've got to make this better. My last book didn't do as good as I wanted it to, so I've got to put it over the top. And that really gets in the way of the story, because you want to be writing something that's fun for you, first of all. And yeah, I think one thing that I have noticed, you become an award winner. And I hope this hasn't happened to me, but a lot of authors become award winners, and they become panelists at big comic cons, and they start teaching, and all of a sudden they stop writing. Mm. And it's because they've become so wise, they can no longer learn anything. And again, this goes back to the curiosity, because, you know, if you're the world expert on writing and you're a teacher and you're amazing, you can't run up to the guy on the side of the road and go like, what's it like to sell fruit? Because that does not fit with the gravitas of your current station. And so, yes, no matter what, you're just a writer. And something that helps me with that is I don't, people talk about killing your babies and letting go and all this stuff. And I don't ascribe to that theory. I'm making Big Macs. I am making hamburgers. And hopefully they bring a bit of joy to whoever is consuming them. And then hopefully they come back and buy another one. But I'm just doing something that's a product that I want to be proud of, but it is not world peace. Mm-hmm. It's a freaking book. And hopefully with that book, you can change somebody's life for the better. But that doesn't mean you have to change them momentously. You just have to be an improving factor on their lives, and that's sufficient. And you'll know if you're doing that. And if you have the capacity to look at a child and smile and play with him or her, or if you have the capacity to visit your parents, if you have the capacity to smile at coworkers, you can do that. Don't stress about it. You will accomplish it, and you don't have to be this crazed freak of goal-oriented weirdness while you're writing. That's part of your business model. But while you're writing, it's very different, and you should be able to enjoy yourself and sit back and laugh and say, I can't believe I do this.
Yeah. And I think that gets easier the more books you have, right? Because at the beginning, you do care. Like newer writers often do compare the having a book to having a baby. Now, you have kids, your wife had them.
Not the same.
Well, exactly. But I'm child-free, happily child-free. But when people say that, I'm like, I think that metaphor works for maybe the first 3 or 4 books. But when you get to 40 books, it is not that you're looking at these as your children, is it?
No.
You're actually looking at them more as kind of employees who work for you.
Yeah. And hopefully that's great. And they're hopefully really good employees that are fun to be around, because if they're not, you fire them. And you don't get to the end of the book before you fire them. You fire them as soon as they're unpleasant. But yeah, that's really great. You want to create a good work environment, and part of that is a fun book. But you can't take yourself so serious. It's like these professional ball players that always kill me. They get up afterwards and they go, yeah, this is the most grueling game we've ever encountered, and we trained for it. And I'm going, you're playing a freaking game, dude, for a living. For a living.
And you're being paid a lot of money.
Right? And it's the same with an author. Even if you're not getting paid a lot, I mean, you're doing something you love of your own free will, and you get to derive pleasure from it. And that's such a rarity in today's world. Mm. So just bask in it a little bit.
Mm. And I do want to come back on the sports metaphor as well, actually, because do you think, I mean, when someone says like Stephen King, people think generally, I guess, of The Shining would probably be like, if people say, well, what did he write? That might come up. Mm. Mainly because it was a film, I think.
Yeah.
You know, when I think of The Stand, he's written a lot of books, like can't say how many, and that's the one I would say. You know, I've read a few of your books, but the one that sticks in my head is The Deep, the one that's up for the award. Yeah, and it's an awesome book. So do you think that, and this is just a recognition of the number of shots you take at the goal. So whatever the goal is, you know, the pinnacle of the hit book, like The Shining, for example, how many shots do you have to take? Because there is the J.K. Rowling side, but of course she tried a lot and got rejected a lot. But do you think it's more a case of writing a lot of books and something might stick out, and you never know what that's going to be?
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, people want to be that first out of the gate. They want to be the debut writer who changes history, like J.K. Rowling, Suzanne Collins, people like that. But the reality is, can anybody tell me really what they've done as a follow-up? I mean, Cuckoo's Calling was kind of middle of the road, and people thought it was okay until they found out it was J.K. Rowling. And then they're like, holy crap, this is the best thing ever. And generally speaking, when you just jump right out of the gate, you don't know how to repeat it. And you don't want a one-hit career, because those people end up living in shacks and planning how to bomb places, you know, like they end up really miserable and unhappy. And what you want to do is practice, 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 write book, 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 so that when you do start making money, it's on kind of a gradual climb, and you know how to repeat the process. Mm. You don't want to make a bunch of money, start living like a king, and then next year have nothing. There's too many artists that suffer that fate, achieve the same result time and again. Again, like the pole vaulter, the person who wins the gold medal isn't necessarily the best in the world. It is the person who can do it right the most regularly. Mm. And that's a very different thing. So you don't want to be J.K. Rowling necessarily. You want to be a person who takes 5-10 years and then after that 10 years has a career that will last them for their life and will be able to find happiness in the thing, in doing for a living the thing that you love. And so, yeah, I'm a big proponent of practice, 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 and you'll have big hits and you'll have small hits, but you'll be able to make money on all of them. And that's a much more stable and pleasant space to occupy.
Yeah. And that gradual climb, that's my experience. I haven't had the breakout, you know, I say yet, you never know. But it doesn't really matter because the steady income climb with each book is what actually gives you that steady base. And I will come back on J.K. Rowling and say, I love her new stuff. I didn't like Harry Potter. Her Robert Galbraith books are excellent. And The Casual Vacancy was brilliant. I think maybe you had to be British because it takes that quintessential British village and just rips it to shreds. It's brilliant. So anyway, that's on J.K. Rowling. But I wanted to just change tack. We're coming to getting out of time, but I did want to ask you about screenwriting because you also sell screenplays. And I think I've been talking about this for probably 18 months now, but I recently went to an adaptation workshop. I've bought Final Draft.
Real.
It is real. Well, it's real. And I also tried. I started with one of my books. I started trying to adapt it and it was fun. Like, I really enjoyed using Final Draft technically. I think it's awesome. So yeah. I'm really keen to do this. So I wanted to ask, is it better to try and adapt an existing book in the hope, really, I guess, that it would get made or get bought and in some way help the sales of that book, or write something from scratch that is more suited to a screenplay that you probably have no chance of necessarily making any money on, but it might be better?
Well, to start with, you have almost no chance of making money whether you do the adaptation or you do the regular one.
But at least you've got the book. If with an adaptation, you're making money on the book.
Yeah. So I have, just to give people a horrible, horrible intro to screenwriting, I'm a member of the Writers Guild of America, which is kind of the most prestigious writing group in the world. And to get into it, you have to have sold some scripts. You have to have made some movies. First of all, it is harder statistically, for real, it's harder to get into that group than to be a major league baseball player. And then when I first went there, we had like an introductory meeting and they said, look to your right. And we did. And they said, that person isn't going to be here in 5 years. Look to your left. And we did. And they said, that person will be gone in 10. And so one out of three people who are the best of the best continue to make money in this business. It's really hard. That being said, personally, I do a bit of both. I mean, most of my books, I either adapt to a screenplay, or some of my books start out as a screenplay and then I adapt them to a book. So they sort of grow up together. And then in between, I also write standalone screenplays, because screenplays, they have a very different sort of feel to them, not just technical writing, but they do different things. They have different purposes. The three basic kinds of storytelling are prose, screenplay, and stage play, and they all have different strengths. The strength of a stage play is man on man. It's two people interacting. The strength of a book of prose is man to himself. And I'm sorry, I'm being sexist. I'm just using it for shorthand. A person to him or herself and internally talking about what's happening. And the strength of a screenplay is a person to the outside world. And that's why you don't have Twister, the stage play, you know, because they have different strengths. And so sometimes you don't want to adapt your book because you're going to find out it's a big talking head show. And that is the kiss of death for a screenplay. Mm. Similarly, again, you have Twister and it makes kind of a poor novel adaptation because it's not about a guy who's thinking about the realities of what's happening. Even in an adventure book, it's like usually comes down to how does this affect me internally, the struggle I have, the morality of it, the personal questions. Oh, and then I'm going to shoot a terrorist. Whereas in a screenplay, it's just boom, 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 and the terrorist is down and I save my daughter and everybody's good. And so you're going to work in different kind of fields with different subject matter. So if you come up with a great idea for a book that you can turn into a screenplay, do it. Monetize it. All the avenues of possible money making you can get, it's a good thing. If you have a great idea that you realize can only be a screenplay and you love this idea, write the frickin' screenplay, because it's going to be wonderful. You know, it's going to be something that's great. And so you do want to have, for me personally, I found it very helpful to have variable income streams. Mm. So I do write screenplays. I do write books. I show up in short story anthologies. Again, I'm making a Big Mac. I'm making a junior Big Mac. I'm making the quarter pounder thing. You know, they're different products. They're different products out of the same kind of milieu, the same kind of production house. And I love screenwriting, but it is also very different than book writing. And just because you know how to put a book together and you have a three-act structure, don't say, I can do a screenplay now, because it is communicating with a completely different language set. I liken book writing to surgery. If you screw up too badly, your patient dies, or in other words, your reader goes away and you don't get their money anymore. Screenwriting is laser surgery. There is much less margin for error. And that makes sense, because a book, you hand someone 400 or 500 pages and say, give me $5. And a screenplay, you hand someone 100 loosely written pages and say, give me enough to buy a house.
And that's why it's more of, it's a bigger gamble, but the odds are so tiny, but if it pays off, it can super, super pay off. Yes. So I have then more of a genre question then, because what I'm struggling with now is I want to now adapt all of my books. So this is what I'm struggling with. So I have, for example, One Day in Budapest, which can be a standalone political thriller about the rise of the far right in Eastern Europe. Very now, very immigrant, you know, racism in Eastern Europe. It can be completely standalone, no supernatural, mainstream action adventure thriller, right? Big budget, mm-hmm. though, would blow stuff up. Then on the other side of the kind of the end, I've got, Risen Gods, which is a horror book, well, dark fantasy thriller that I wrote with Jay Thorne, who you've worked with before.
Awesome guy.
And this has demons and like a lot of supernatural stuff, and it's set in New Zealand. And mm-hmm. and so I'm like, okay, these are two very different things. So I pretty much understand how I would write a political thriller in a screenplay, because, you know, I just take the Bourne ultimatum and have a look at how that's done, you know, is that
which is a wonderful screenplay, by the way. Read that script.
Yeah, well, I've got that and I understand that, and I've got something else that could be like Gone Girl, and I've got that script, and that's great. But Risen Gods, with this kind of supernatural side, and given you write horror with demons and stuff too, how do you, I mean, do you just literally write demon rises from the ground, or do you have to do a lot more work around that supernatural side?
Well, okay, so in movies, it's actually tough, because as soon as you show the demon, the movie's over. really, because everyone goes, oh, it's a guy in a suit, or even worse, oh, it's CGI. A CGI effect. Yeah. And so, I mean, if you're doing like a horror comedy, that's fine, because people don't mind a bit of cheese. But yeah, when I'm writing a supernatural thriller or a supernatural horror, you definitely have to write that very carefully. And you can't describe the demon head to toe, because that's the special effects guy's job. But again, because screenwriting is laser surgery, what you're going to say is, you know, a demon rises from the ground, dripping with ichor and looking like he just killed Satan himself. And so there you've got kind of a really peppy, pithy one-liner, and it should set up an image in the other person's head, and they're going to run with it. But yeah, as soon as you get to supernatural, it's really kind of hinky. It's difficult to work with, because you're going to have this very clear image. And no matter what, that's something that is hard to get used to, is you write a book and it's you and an editor and a cover designer. Write a movie and it's all 1,000 of those people whose names crawl past at the end, and every single one of them has the complete and utter power to screw up your movie. And so you have to be really careful how you describe things and how you build them in, because otherwise they're just going to get tossed out or replaced with something else. And that's a reality of the collaborative effect of movies. So yeah, writing demons, writing monsters is very tough, because again, unless you keep them in the shadows, it's going to be a terrible movie. Mm. And every single genre has its pitfalls. I will say, if you're going to start writing screenplays, horror is a great place to start, because people are always looking for it. It's got a built-in audience. It's cheap, which they love. Like your political thriller, the first thing I would do with it is make sure it's set in downtown Idaho, because like going
it's
to
in Budapest.
Right. And people are going to look at a first script by a first time screenwriter, and they're going to say, do we really want to spend $100 million on this unknown quantity? But if you write a horror story that's set in the woods, the person, you know, the producer looks at it and goes, it's going to cost 65 cents to make. We can risk that. So be cognizant of your budget for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, last question then, because not that I'm ambitious at all, none of us are, obviously. But I mean, my ideal director and studios and everything for Risen Gods would be Peter Jackson and Weta in New Zealand, because, you know, he does that kind of stuff. They do okay. Plus, he's done horror stuff. He does supernatural. He does grisly creatures, and he does New Zealand. So this is kind of what I was thinking. So if you have someone in mind, I'm not saying it has to be Peter Jackson, but do you ever recommend trying to pitch directly, or do you recommend going through an agent who might have relationships?
Well, the answer to that is good luck pitching directly. They're never going to talk to you. The way Hollywood works, it's on relationships. So the way I sold my first script was I spent 10 years foodling around with people until I finally met the right one at the right time, who was willing to make my movie. But the reality is, even him, I stayed on top of his radar for 4 or 5 years so that he would keep my screenplay on his desk. And when his boss finally walked in and said, I want to make a ghost story, he was like, oh, Michael Brent just emailed the other day. I just thought of him. Here, take this one. So you're probably not going to get to pitch to your wish dream director or cinematographer or anybody. What you're going to do is you're going to meet somebody whose hairdresser also knows the hairdresser, you know, and you're going to give them your screenplay and hope it winds up over there. I was just a really funny story. I was in a room where you do a lot of thinking and maybe some reading. Yes. Okay, fine. I was trying not to be a crass American. So I was on the toilet and my wife knocks on the door and I was like, yeah. And she goes, someone's on the phone. And I said, can it wait? I'm occupied at the moment. And she said, it's Jean-Claude Van Damme. And I said, slide the phone under the door. And so me and JC had this really interesting conversation where, you know, I'm just not in a position to normally talk to this guy. But you do what you have to. And the reason he had it was because I knew the tutor of his children. Okay. And I handed this tutor one of my scripts, and the tutor handed it to his wife, and his wife handed it to Jean-Claude. And he called up and said, I love this movie, you know, and I didn't know him and I wasn't going to meet him. But you make all of these connections leading to more connections. And getting a screenplay made is like coral growing. It's an accretive process. It's one little bit at a time. You know, the Great Barrier Reef is this enormous structure, but it is made out of the bones of micro monocellular creatures. And so you're going to meet somebody who doesn't know anybody, but he knows somebody who might know somebody. And so you meet that person and you meet another person. And after 10 years, yes, you finally meet somebody who knows your director or a manager who knows the director. If you can get an agent early on or a manager, they do slightly different things. You probably want to, because they're going to be able to whore for you better than you can. But definitely start making these introductions to people who know people who know people, because down the line, it's going to bear fruit. And that's the way Hollywood works. You, even when they love your script, you always have what I call the a-hole meeting, which is where they bring you in and sit down and talk to you about nothing at all, because they're trying to decide if you're a tool or if they like you. So Hollywood is really, it's very relationship oriented, and the more relationships you can accrue, the better off you'll be.
No, fantastic advice. Okay, I could carry on talking to you for ages, but we'll have to stop there. So where can people find you and your books and everything online?
easiest way is just to type in my name. My first name is Michael Brent. And if you type it in Google, I'm the only Michael Brent in the world. And you'll get my website and you'll get my Amazon page and my Barnes & Noble page and all that stuff. Or obviously you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and type that in. And my website is michaelbrentcollings.com. And again, if you type that into Google and butcher it completely, nobody else has that name and Google will get you there.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Michael Brent. That was so much fun.
Thank you. I always enjoy hanging out with you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.